Greetings. I'm Austin Egbert, the director of Mind Matters News. Welcome to another special BingeCast episode, where multiple interviews are fused into a single program. Today's BingeCast features a discussion with Daniel Ogden on intellectual property and the precautions and measures that are taken to protect it. Enjoy.
Welcome to Mind Matters News, where artificial and natural intelligence meet head-on. Here's your host, Robert J. Marks.
Greetings. Today's podcast will be made from the perspective of America, but it's applicable to any developed country pursuing technical advances. Technology is valuable. Corporations spend billions in development, and they don't want to get ripped off. Technology and AI, more than ever, determine military superiority to protect every research university and major technical company in the United States is required to obey and enforce export compliance. I'm not a big fan of most federally imposed compliance, but protecting technology is important. It needs to be done. We have here as our guest today an expert who is dedicated to technology protection. Daniel M. Ogden, J.D., is the Director of Export Compliance and is the University Export Control Officer at Baylor University. He is the Directorate of Defense Trade Controls Empowered Official. Let me say that again because it's a pretty long title. He is the Directorate of Defense Trade Controls Empowered Official. Daniel, did I say that right, Dan?
Yes, okay. Actually at Baylor University.
At Baylor University, okay. Yes. Daniel is an attorney at law, licensed custom broker, and international trade consultant who for more than 25 years has counseled and represented companies on various aspects of international trade and business. He served as the chair of the National District Export Council and also as the chair of the National District Export Council Trade Policy Committee. He was appointed to the North Texas District Export Council in 2008 by the U.S. Secretary of Commerce. In this capacity, he serves as chair of both the Compliance and Security Committee and the Export University Committee. It looks like you've done a lot, Dan.
Thanks, Bob. It's been an interesting career involvement, a lot of organizations, a lot of fun things, and it's kind of got me to the point where I'm here now at Baylor.
Okay, wonderful. I did want to mention, by the way, Mr. Ogden is not speaking today on behalf of Baylor University, and his comments and the views expressed are strictly his own. So with that caveat, let's go ahead and get started. Dan, clearly not all technology is protected. So stuff I do, which I publish in publications, is not protected. What are some examples of things which are protected technology?
Well, before I get into that little bit of some examples, the reason we have technology controls, actually they're called export controls, in the United States and in most of our allies around the world is primarily for two reasons. First and foremost is national security reasons, but also is to protect the U.S. industrial base. And we can talk about that in a little bit, but that is an area of increasing emphasis. So we have these technology controls because we're concerned that foreign adversaries can use these the technologies to harm the United States in terms of posing security threats as well as to outcompete us in terms of industrial development and technological development.
Okay, so how do you determine the list of things which you need to protect?
Well, there are basically two lists that the U.S. government has compiled. One is a list called the U.S. Munitions List, and this is a list that's maintained by the U.S. Department of State and particularly the Defense Directorate of Trade Controls. It's called the DDTC. You know, the government loves acronyms.
Yes, and they even have acronyms that have acronyms in them.
That's exactly
it's
right.
It's amazing, yeah.
And so the items on the U.S. munitions list are those items called – they're called defense articles and systems. These are products and technologies that are specifically designed for military use. For example, a tank is on there. Now, when it comes to, like, weapons – some weapons, for example, and this is a type of thing that's controlled in terms of technology, like rifle scopes. Some rifle scopes that are designed specifically for military use are maintained on the U.S. munitions list or the USML. But then there's a second list of items that's maintained by the U.S. Department of Commerce. And the agency there is called the Bureau of Industry and Security, or BIS. And they maintain a list of items called the Commerce Control List. And these items are what are called dual-use items or dual-use technologies. They're items that can be used for either military or commercial use, but they're not specifically designed.
Are those restricted?
Let's jump back a little bit. Items on the USML, in order to export any item or technology behind that item to another country, always requires an export license. On the commercial or the CCL, the Commerce Control List, items on that list are controlled for export depending upon what country they're going to, who is using items, what it's being used for, how it's being used, things of that nature. So you can have, for example, a rifle scope that's controlled for export to one country and thereby requires a license, but not to another country. And in fact, I have a former client of mine who had a rifle scope controlled for export to Canada because Canada is part of the what's called the Firearms Convention, whereas other countries which were not members of this convention and actually would not be nearly as close of an ally to the U.S., you could freely export rifle scopes. But in terms of the items that are controlled for export, these are primarily going to be cutting-edge items and items that have potential to really do the U.S. harm.
One of the things I think you mentioned to me in a conversation was the centrifuge, that you can't export the centrifuge, which right. kind of surprised me. But there's a reason for that, right?
Yeah, and one of the biggest reasons we have export controls is to prevent proliferation of nuclear weapons. And so that obviously items that can be used directly to develop nuclear weapons are require either a license or may not even be able to be exported in general. You know, we have these controls in regards to countries like Iran, and of course now with the administration's termination of the agreement with Iran, many of these controls are going to be reinstituted. So those type of controls that are sanctioned, you can't export those items at all. But then there's a lot of other countries around the world. For example, take the country of Sri Lanka. It's not an adversary of the United States, but it's not necessarily a close ally. And for countries like that, there are requirements for export licenses for certain items. And by the way, an export license is basically where the government gives you a permission slip, saying, yes, you can export this item.
Are they easy to get, or is there a big bureaucracy behind them?
Well, the process has improved over the years. There is an automated process, and it's better. But what happens when you have an item that requires an export license? The government will get together, and quite often it'll be several government agencies called an interagency task force. They'll take a look at what it is you're exporting, where it's going to, perhaps how much of it is. And they'll make a determination as to whether or not to grant the license. For some items, pretty much, you know, going to certain countries, good luck. You're not going to get it. For other items, basically the government's just trying to really keep track of what's going where. So a lot of the export control regime is just merely there so the government has information as to what's going where and perhaps how it's being used.
One of the things that I've found interesting is that the U.S. government also mandates that you keep track of traveling professors so that if a professor goes to a country, that has to be approved in some fashion. Is that right?
Well, it depends. I hate to say it depends, but a lot of things in this area is it depends. Certainly, it depends where the professor is going, what they're going to be doing in that location, what they're taking with them. So, for example, if a professor was going to go to take Iran and maybe participate in some conference on, I don't know, fighting hunger, something that really is pretty much innocuous, they probably could go ahead and do it, but they certainly couldn't take their laptop with them and anything like that. On the other hand,
really? Laptops.
Perhaps. Okay. Going to a country like Iran, for example, if a Baylor professor was going to go to Iran, I would strongly advise against that. But if you're going to China, it's not going to be a problem, provided that you don't have any controlled technology or data on the laptop, which is why we recommend a clean laptop.
This is really interesting. About a decade ago, when I went to some of the DOD labs, you weren't allowed to have a cell phone with a camera in them. So many people bought cell phones and they bought a ballpoint pen and they kind of stabbed it in the eyeball right where the camera was so that they could have a cell phone inside the DOD. And these were U.S. citizens with clearances.
Well, and we have another issue with when it comes to universities in particular, and that has to do with what are called foreign nationals. A foreign national is someone who is not either a U.S. citizen or a U.S. resident, which in common parlance is called a green card holder, or there's someone who has not been granted asylum. And the reason we have that third exception is quite often you'll have individuals from foreign countries that perhaps have some export controls on them, but this individual's fleeing persecution, something of that nature. But in any
that's
event,
different. Yeah.
Yeah, in any event, a foreign national that's exposed to controlled technology will require, in many instances, what's called a deemed export license. In other words, the government deems that an export has occurred. So, for example, if a U.S. citizen was to go over to, say, for example, China and participate in some activity there, bringing technology with them that's controlled for export, that would be just the same thing as if a Chinese citizen in the U.S. was given that technology, say, by a professor.
I see.
That's why it's deemed to be an export.
Well, here is something interesting. I would imagine that some places like Lockheed and some of the defense contractors, it would be relatively easy to maintain export control, especially about intellectual property. But universities are often funded by the Department of Defense. Austin Egbert and I are currently funded by the ARL, and we've been funded by the Office of Naval Research. And there's every one of the branches of the military has a research office, and they fund university sort of research opportunities. And the other thing is that there are these kind of pseudo places like the Applied Physics Lab at the University of Washington, which is kind of a paramilitary organization which is associated with the university. ARL, Advanced Research Lab at Penn State, Lincoln Labs at MIT. And it has been claimed that we're getting a lot of leaks in terms of stolen technology from these sort of scenarios. I ran across an article by Bloomberg that said in February 2018, FBI Director Christopher Wray told a Senate Intelligence Committee hearing that Chinese students, academics, and researchers are exploiting the U.S.'s, quote, very open research and development environment and constitute a, quote, whole of society threat. Wow. So to what degree in your experience is this true?
Well, fortunately, we in the time that I've been the Director of Export Compliance at Baylor University, we haven't had this occurrence. Mm-hmm. But as a general matter, I think that statement is very accurate. One thing I should point out in the university context is that in regard to research, there is this very large exception called the fundamental research exception. And what this means is that if the research being conducted is of a certain nature, then the export control laws are exempted from applying to that research. For example, when you do research on fundamentals of physics, doing experiments as to speed of light, for example, I mean, that's something that, you know, that's just kind of out there. It's just what's there. What happens, however, is when you take that research and it becomes proprietary. In other words, you patent it, or you want to seek to license it, or you commercialize it, or you restrict its publication. In other words, it's not openly published. At that point, the fundamental research exception goes away. Now, the problem is that's a gray line. It's not always black and white. So that's one issue that always has to be considered. But the other thing is, and this is kind of a dual type of issue, because the threat the United States faces isn't just from a legal acquisition, you could say, of technology, but also espionage. And so even if you're involved in fundamental research and the fundamental research exception applies to that activity, you can still have an espionage. And so you know, there isn't anything called an export license for espionage because espionage is illegal.
I hope not. I hope if there was an application for espionage, it would be turned down.
Yeah, okay. So you have both the concern of technology that kind of makes its way over to another country through some legal means, but that requires an export license. And then you have technology that makes its way to another country illegally through espionage. And so they're related, but they're a little bit different in the way in which they're managed.
What is interesting is that as a professor, I get email at least once a month from either China or Iran from students wanting to come and visit and study in the United States. And indeed, many of our graduate students across the United States are graduate students from China, and they're good graduate students. They're smart people, and also graduate students from Iran. This always seemed kind of problematic to me insofar as getting close to any sort of military research.
Well, of course, the universities are open environments in that sense, and we certainly want to have the best and the brightest from overseas come and study, and that's something that every university competes with other universities for. But when we do get foreign students, the same way that foreign professors, example, visiting professors, same thing with foreign students, they can't be involved in anything in which it's outside of the fundamental research area where there's controlled technology. There's a very famous case called the Tennessee professor went to jail. If you Google that, the Tennessee professor went to jail, you will discover a professor, and I believe he was in the STEM area, University of Tennessee, Knoxville, a few years ago. And I believe he had a Chinese graduate assistant, something to that effect, working with him on a project. And he'd been warned that this person required a deemed export license, and he basically just ignored the warnings. And he's now in jail. And so
– the professor.
Yes. Now, the student wasn't, because you see, that's the thing. If the student is not doing anything illegal unless they're engaged in espionage. But if they're not engaged in espionage – they're not doing anything illegal, but it's the university that has the obligation, if it's required in that instance, to have a deemed export license. The student, the foreign national doesn't apply for that license. So it's not like they are breaking the law. It would be the institution of the university, if an export license is required, that would be violating the law.
Well, let's talk about the more general case. All major businesses like Google, Facebook, of course, the DoD contractors, Lockheed, Raytheon, Martin Marietta, all need to comply with the export compliance. But it does turn out that many of the organizations, especially places like Facebook, Amazon, and Microsoft, really don't want to participate in that. In fact, I got a quote here from Wired magazine that says Facebook, Amazon, and Microsoft have all, like Google, released as open source software AI that their own engineers use for machine learning, all including, to some extent, famously secretive Apple, encouraged their AI researchers to openly publish their latest ideas, helping the companies recruit the brightest faculty and graduate students from universities. So therefore, there isn't a lot of interest in keeping AI secret. I know that encryption was something that the government wanted to keep secret, PGP encryption, and boom, it went out. It was released, and so everybody had it. And so it would be something that they would have liked to do. And I'm wondering if this sort of thing is happening at some of these organizations like Facebook, Amazon, and Microsoft that are developing AI.
Well, there's a reason why they can do that. That's because open source software is not even subject to the Export Administration regulations.
Really?
Yes. Now, the only place that you couldn't transfer it to, so to speak, would be a country where there's some other type of overriding trade sanctions. But open source software is not even subject to export control. And so, but see, this is where the issue is somewhat bifurcated. Just because it's not subject to export control doesn't mean that it's necessarily in the U.S. interest to allow that to occur. And this is where the whole idea of protection of the industrial base comes into play. And for example, the best case of this recently is in the case where the Broadcom proposed acquisition of Qualcomm was nixed by the administration because even though that wouldn't have violated most likely export control laws, it was deemed to be a threat to the U.S. technology competitiveness. So you've got some – so what you have here is some different policy objectives. And so one policy objective may say, oh, it's okay. But another policy objective say, may it's not. And so therefore, you know, how do you respond to that? But open source software is not controlled for export. Now, when it comes to encryption, the PGP example, that was open source. But there are certain encryption items that are controlled for export, depending upon the level of encryption.
You mentioned that encryption was one of the on the list of things that we want to protect.
And it keeps changing. For example, items that have – we have items, for example, cell phones that are called mass market consumer items. And if they have – and, of course, every cell phone has encryption because we know that back in the old days of cell phones first came out, you could get a scanner and listen to somebody's conversation.
Yeah.
Now, of course, they're all digitally encrypted for privacy purposes. And so now the regulation of it is if it's 128-bit encryption or higher, which 4G and higher cell phones use and even some 3G, then there isn't any requirement for a license, but there is a requirement basically where the government is able to track where cell phones are going because they're used a lot in IEDs. So encryption is an area where some things in regard to encryption are not controlled, other things are. And again, what and it's always a change in landscape because technology is always developing, getting more sophisticated. For example, when it comes to computer technology and the speed of processors, stuff that 20 years ago was controlled, now, I mean, your cell phone's even faster, and so that's not controlled anymore. So it's constantly this technology race that the government's having to say, okay, this item is so widely available that there's no point in trying to control it. And so you're always looking at the leading edge, the cutting edge, and increasingly what are called critical technologies, which raises another issue with the development. This particularly applies to AI, robotics, things of this nature, where you have these new technologies being developed. The government is having a hard time keeping up and determining whether or not these items should be controlled for export. And that's a big challenge. I was just at a conference that BIS holds every year called
BIS,
Bureau of Industry and Security, okay. Department of Commerce. They have this big conference every year called BIS Update. And they just admitted freely at that conference that in the area of new and critical technologies, that they're struggling in the sense to keep track with what's going on because the speed of technological development, particularly in the area of AI, is so it just accelerates.
We're just exploding exponentially.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, I know that talking to you that you are one that really is interested in the implications of technology and war. And I agree with you that technology wins wars. You're an amateur buff in the use of the technology in the military. Give us a quick overview.
Well, this is a very interesting topic and one that I'm a student of military history. And what you will see in terms of technology, kind of just as an overview, and I'll provide some specific examples, is that technology in terms of military use does not – technological development, I should say, does not occur in a vacuum. It really occurs because of the needs. And what happens is throughout history, the nature of warfare tends to shift between offensive measures and defensive measures. And so you'll have a particular offensive measures that are used, and so technological development will increase the defense, and I'll switch back and forth. Let me give you some examples. Without going too far back, siege warfare, of course, has been used for centuries. And when the Chinese invented
gun siege warfare, that's when somebody comes in and surrounds a city.
You have a castle and you have some type of stronghold defense, a stronghouse, so to speak, in which you defend whatever you're defending. And the traditional way was to starve these individuals out, et cetera. If you saw the movie Lord of the Rings, you had very interesting ways in which they conducted siege warfare there. But the real big development really began in technological development was the Chinese invention of gunpowder, because that enabled artillery. And for the first time, you had a weapon that could actually be effective at some distance in conducting siege warfare. You know, previously you had catapults and things of that nature, but they were hard to use. They weren't very accurate. Now, of course, early artillery in the 15th century, for example, that used by Henry V in the Battle of Agincourt was not very accurate either. But as time went on, artillery increased in its accuracy. And so that gave the balance to the offense, although artillery also began to use in defensive measures. You really went on the offensive. For example, Napoleon was an artillery officer, and his very skilled use of artillery really is what led to his ability to engage in the victories on the battle he engaged in. So the next big development was the use of rifled guns and automatic weapons. Rifle guns enabled a greater distance for projectile, more accurate. And then, of course, automatic weapons, beginning with, you know, automatic pistols as well as rifles themselves, but particularly the Gatling gun and machine gun, that totally changed the balance of power over to the defense. And this is why the Civil War had such horrific casualties that had never been seen in warfare before, because the power of the defense. And, of course, it was even worse in World War I because
they were fighting using old strategy.
They were using Napoleonic tactics on the battlefield. And once you had the defense through automatic weapons, through rifle guns, and of course better artillery, it became a slaughter. And then World War I was the total apex of this, because by that time the machine gun, which was only in its very infancy in the Civil War, really became such a potent weapon. So what had to happen is military planners said, we need to use technology to develop a counterweapon. And this actually began World War I with the development of the tank and the use of aircraft, but it reached its apex in World War II. And when particularly the Germans, through their use of armored warfare, which, by the way, they got their ideas from a couple of British military historians named J.F.C. Fuller and Little Hart, the whole theory of armored warfare and blitzkrieg, and the Germans became experts at that, the use of the tank and the aircraft to put the balance back to the offensive. Of course, at the end of the war, and this is quite often what happens, is technology.
This is the end of World War One, you mean?
At the end of World War II,
I'm sorry.
Yeah, what often happens is when the war is being fought, then you're looking to develop technology then to counter the enemy. And of course, at the end of World War II, the big technology was atomic weapons.
Yes.
And then the development of atomic and nuclear weapons really changed the game, because almost then now you had a strategic force in which you could inflict devastation on an enemy, and particularly when we developed missile technology and ICBMs and multiple entry MIRVs, they're called. That enabled you to be able to strike at the enemy from halfway around the world. And that, of course, led to what was called the Doctrine of Mutual Assured Destruction, MAD. And so that led to a stalemate. And then, of course, we have the development by President Reagan of SDI, which, again, tempting to provide.
I had an SDI grant, by the
way.
I'm that old.
And the SDI, of course, was developed as a defensive measure. So what we see then in summary.
SDI, we should say, means Strategic Defense Initiative.
Yeah, basically missile defense, being able to shoot weapons out at current stages. And this is still ongoing. You know, during the first Gulf War, we had the Patriot missile and all that. And then what we see then throughout military history in relation to technology is you have one side, the offensive gains superiority, and then that leads to technological development, switch to the defense. But the point is that necessity, as we all know, is the mother of invention. And necessity is really what drives technological development in terms of military use.
You know, I followed the technology development in World War II, and eventually I want to get to today and AI and its use in warfare and what we can do there. But in World War II, I'm an engineer, and I celebrate how engineers helped win World War II. There was something called the Borden gun sight?
Yes, that's correct.
That was
used for bombing. It was critical because enabled – in World War I, when they dropped bombs, they were guessing.
Yes.
The Norton gunsight enabled a precision dropping of ordnance.
But what it did, it is so cool. It actually used a computer, an analog computer, that you gave at the site where you wanted to drop the bomb. The computer actually took over the control of the aircraft and released the bomb.
I did not realize that.
Yeah, so it was really, really advanced stuff. And I read in the book Unbroken, which is the story about
great book.
Yeah, it is a great book. The gentleman that spent all that time at sea and was a prisoner in Japan and ultimately came to Christ with the Billy Graham Crusade. I think that the second movie is out about that. But he was on an airplane, and he said that the Norton gun sight was such that if he was shot down, they were instructed to destroy it so that enemy hands wouldn't get on it.
Exactly. It was revolutionary. Of course, the British radar also was critical to the Britain winning the Battle of Britain against the Luftwaffe.
Absolutely. So. And I have a story which I have confirmed that the Germans, the Nazis, were really concerned that we were shooting them, and it wasn't a clear day, that some way we were seeing through the fog, and they actually let it leak that United States or Allied pilots were eating carrots. And they were going to eat these carrots in order to improve their eyesight. And like any good propaganda, it just had that pinch of truth in it that that makes it believable. So that was very interesting. But also, of course, the cracking of Enigma was another one of the engineering accomplishments. Radar, we borrowed, I guess, from the Britons, didn't we?
Oh, yeah, the British basically invented radar.
Yeah.
But again, we see this. Measure, countermeasure.
Yes.
Measure, countermeasure.
Except,
measure, countermeasure.
Except when we got to the atomic bomb.
Except when we got the atomic bomb, because there wasn't an effective countermeasure for years and years. And of course, it's still debatable as to how effective missile defense is, but at least it's something. But yes, with atomic weapons for decades, the only thing that was the defensive countermeasure was mutual assured destruction. That was it.
And I'm wondering if, as we talk a little bit, I wonder if we're going to get to mutually assured destruction with some things in AI. Yeah, in World War II, I had an uncle, my Uncle Junior. That was his name, Uncle Junior. He was trained as a paratrooper that was supposed to drop behind Japan with 24 pounds of explosives on his legs in order to blow up things. And he was so happy when the atomic bomb went up because he was sure that he was going to get killed. But because of what happened, the way that the bomb ended the war, he was able to come back. He settled in West Virginia. He was a Greyhound bus driver and spent a great, flourishing life. So it was really, really amazing. You know, something else I found out. This is something about the U.S. and protected technology. I have this book at home, and it's the covers of the New York Times newspaper. And one of the pages which actually announces the victory in Japan, there's a little panel in that same page that says United States releases all radar information. So on the victory on Japan Day or thereabout, the United States released all of the radar technology to the world, realizing that it would probably have some great impact on commercial airlines and avoiding other things. I thought that was really interesting. Up to then, you know, that was just top secret, but you didn't need it then. Let's talk about artificial intelligence. Before we started, I just showed you a video called Slaughterbots. We also read headlines, killer AI robot army that could destroy humanity. And there is a movement now to ban fully autonomous weapons which are generated and controlled by AI that have taken man out of the loop. And there are organizations which are actually started towards doing this, to do this banning. Do you have any thoughts on that?
It's not going to work. Even if you could have some type of international organization where perhaps a treaty where every single country of the world would agree to it. Of course, you have non-state actors such as ISIS and Al-Qaeda, which, you know, obviously are not going to agree to it. But aside from that fact alone, there's really no way to enforce it. You know, we have had some things throughout history that have been banned. For example, during World War I, obviously poison gas was used a lot. Yeah. And countries came together after in the interwar period to ban that. One of the reasons
that was kind of a mutually assured destruction, wasn't it?
It really was, because there's no way to control the wind blowing. And so the poison gas you inflict upon the enemy could just quickly come back upon you. And that's the fact why both sides would have gas masks. And I think that there was such an impractical use of technology that the nations decided it's just not worthwhile doing it. You know, we've had attempts, of course, to prevent nuclear nonproliferation. We see how that goes. And I think the nuclear nonproliferation issue is a good example of this. It's really hard to prevent bad people from doing bad things when they have bad intentions.
Exactly. And I think foundational to the Judeo-Christian ethic is that men and women are fallen, and that there are going to be bad people that develop this technology independent of what the rest of the world says.
And that's right. And so not only is it probably impractical that occur, but also I think it would be foolish for the United States to do that, because in order to retain our technological edge and superiority, we need to be the ones out front developing this. The fact of the matter is it's going to develop. You know, some of the AI stuff, there's a lot of potential for a lot of good anyway. So, you know, it's like anything else. Guns can be used for good things. They can be used for bad things. Fire. I mean, it's one of the four basic elements that cavemen were using. They can be used for good and for bad. And so the same thing with the AI. It really has to do with who's using it and for what reason. So I think from a practical measure, for a strategic measure, and also for moral measure, I would be against that.
You know, about the idea of good and evil, there was a recent case of a couple named Jane Austen and Lauren Geoghegan, who wanted to take a bike trip through hostile area in, I don't know how to say this, Tajikistan?
Tajikistan.
One of the stands. One of the stands.
Exactly.
That's right. And they wanted to go through ISIS territory in order to demonstrate the innate, inherent human kindness in the world. And of course, they were killed by ISIS in doing that. So I think that any sort of ban on development of AI would be very, very sad, and I think would have some very bad implications. In fact, I think we could go back to the end of World War II. Imagine a protest in the United States about development of the atomic bomb. And suppose that it took place and we quit developing the atomic bomb because it could kill tens and hundreds of thousands of people. If we had stopped developing the atomic bomb, we would probably be flying swastikas today instead of American flags.
Well, we would have had a million casualties and taken the island of Japan. And
And
the Japanese would have suffered probably 10 million casualties. So it actually, as horrific as the atomic bomb was, it actually saved lives.
Yeah, I probably misspoke. Of course, it wasn't time enough in order for the Nazis to win, because the Nazis lost before the atomic bomb.
But nevertheless,
they were working on it.
They were working on it. Fortunately, scientists like Einstein and others fled Germany, came to the United States. So even if Einstein was not directly involved in developing the nuclear weapons, but the fact that he was out of Germany and others like him certainly helped.
Now, in this video, Slaughterbots, that we just watched, there was a swarm of little drones, and these drones actually had the capability of facial recognition, and they also had a shaped explosive inside. And they could actually fly around. They were about the size of a half dollar. And they could fly around and do facial recognition, and they could go up and land themselves on the forehead of their target individual and put off an explosive and kill the person. And of course, the person that put this out is a Berkeley professor, and he wants to ban the research into all of the autonomous weapons. Now, this weapon that they talked about is horrific, but you know, if we don't do it, somebody else is going to do it, aren't they?
That is correct. I mean, again, by the United States staying out ahead and leading the way in this, we actually can arguably control perhaps the use of it, rather than not doing the research here, letting other countries do it, and then being able to hold us hostage.
And again, I point back to World War II and all of the technology that allowed us to win there. It's just who keeps ahead. You know, as an engineer, when I saw that, I started to think, what are some countermeasures? What are some ways that we can get in the way of these Slaughterbots? By the way, the Slaughterbots, they're totally fictional. But I actually think that current technology could probably allow them to work. So that's the next question, too. Is this something that could be trumped by additional technology? Or is it going to be an end game where you like the gas in World War I or the atomic bomb, where we actually have a mutually assured destruction sort of compromise that we just have to live with?
And that's I mean, as if that scenario ever would come about, as horrible as the video showed it to be, that might be one way to prevent its use. The fact that the United States would have that same capability means that actually would be a defensive measure. Because if another country was to launch an attack on the U.S. in that manner, they would risk the same thing happening to themselves. That's correct.
What are some other of the implications of AI in current?
Well, we have, of course, things like smart bombs, cognitive radar, facial recognition, and also one area that I think AI, both in terms of offensive and defensive measures, probably is increasing is the whole area of cybersecurity. And that I do know I've read reports that the Chinese in particular have developing technologies that would hamper in a cyber attack some of our high-level missile defenses, things of this nature. So obviously every advanced weapon system we have today is going to depend to some measure upon computer technology, and therefore the ability to protect against cyber attacks is going to be really, really critical. And not only to our infrastructure itself, of course, such as the electrical grid, things of that nature, but also our own military capabilities.
One of the classic applications of I don't know if you would call it AI, but certainly cybersecurity, was the United States' infection of the Iranian nuclear facility with something called the Stuxnet worm, and it infiltrated the nuclear facility and just kind of screwed up their, I guess it was a centrifuge. And that was
never been
cool.
Never been admitted by the U.S., but of course everyone knows that we did.
Well, the thing is too, I think that people came out and said, yeah, we did it. I think there were lots of leaks, which was really stupid, because if you have something that effective that is going to be used as a weapon, you should keep that quiet, because as soon as somebody finds out about it, they're going to do counter sort of technology.
And this kind of circles back to the conversation we had in the previous episode about controls on the technology behind AI. And again, this both in terms of national security purposes as well as protection of our technological edge. The United States, again, we have to be in the forefront of AI development. There's a lot of great, wonderful, peaceful uses for AI, but we also, fortunately, we do live in a world that's composed of bad people who want to do bad things for bad purposes. And therefore, we do have to also develop military technologies that use AI to defend ourselves.
So there is a website, stopkillerrobots.org, and they're trying to pressure companies such as Amazon, Microsoft, and Oracle to publicly endorse the call to ban fully autonomous weapons and to commit to never develop these weapons. I think this gets back to the soft problem that we had before. If they don't, somebody else is.
Yeah, I don't think that the Chinese technology companies or the Russian technology companies are going to be adopting that policy. So I
agree.
Don't think we should either.
Okay. Well, Dan, thank you very much. I've learned a lot, and it's been fun talking with you. Thank you for being on the broadcast.
And, you're welcome.
And so that ends this episode. So until next time, be of good cheer.
This has been Mind Matters News with your host, Robert J. Marks. Explore more at mindmatters.ai. That's mindmatters.ai. Mind Matters News is directed and edited by Austin Egbert. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers. Mind Matters News is produced and copyrighted by the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence at Discovery Institute.